Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, I'm Nils. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
Nils. And I'm an addict, but I won't talk about that right now. My home group is Knuckleheads. It's a men's meeting that happens on Tuesday nights. I have a sponsor who just decided he wasn't going to be in AA anymore. So after working with him for 14 months, so I quickly found a new sponsor. I've gone through the steps. I have a couple sponsees. It took me about 4 to 5 years since I've been in this program till I got about almost 15 months now. First off, I'm just going to talk about something I'm just going through that just happened. I'm a little depressed right now. I just had a meeting with my boss, and things didn't go the way I wanted them to. In the past, when things haven't gone the way I wanted them to, I had to do something about it. Whether that was drink or do anything else. But I'm here today to share my experience, strength, and hope, because I don't have those kind of choices. I mean, I have those choices still, but my decisions right now are all based on staying sober, because I've found that living one day at a time has been my best opportunity for constant hope and improvement. So I'm also in another program, which has been helping me learn things about myself that I never took the time to figure out or whatever. I'm a really slow processor of stuff. I have no idea who I am or what made me who I am, but I'm learning about it. I got bit by a dog when I was 2 years old because my parents left me in a room alone with it. I didn't ever realize how much that impacted how I became so untrusting of authority, why I was so angry, why I didn't want to listen to what anybody said, which is probably why it took a long time for me to start taking any, you know, input from people in this program. I grew up so naive and so dense that some examples of some first impressions I made on kids growing up would be, I went to a Cub Scout meeting and I went down to the basement with everybody and asked about all the tools. I had this really bad horror movie obsession. I asked, what were the best tools to kill people with? And I didn't understand why the kids didn't like me. I rode in a car with this guy once. He told me I was annoying, and I had no idea what that meant. And I asked him for an hour and a half drive why I was annoying. So by the time I got to really feeling out of place and uncomfortable, and I took those first drinks, I don't know, like it was something that I just kept drinking, and I didn't stop until I woke up the next morning. And I remembered it. I was embarrassed about the night. I don't remember much of it, but I was 12 years old, and I discovered other things after that, and I'll just say drinking for everything, just so you guys can be comfortable. But I'm involved in I've done everything, and I remembered what it was like. Let me just look at my time right now. Where's that timer at? Oh, okay. I want to get to the point. Anyway, so I lived my life for me my whole life. Anything that got in my way, if I couldn't do anything about it, I just went around it with my own way of doing things. I graduated high school by manipulating the college program. I drank whenever there was a good time to drink. At first, I was drinking all through my teens. One experience that I can definitely always remember where I understood why alcohol made me feel comfortable no matter what was because there was this 4th of July, and I didn't have any friends where I was at. I mean, or I didn't really think anyone liked me, I've pretty much given up on trying to be friends with most of them too. And I drank and I did something else, and I got to the point where everyone was like shooting firecrackers at me. And before, where I would feel like, why are people picking on me? Be all sensitive. I just didn't care. And that was like something that made me realize like how much alcohol could do for me. And as I drank that throughout my teens, I got arrested a few times. When I was 17, I assaulted a police officer. Thank God I wasn't 18, because that would be an assault felony, and that wouldn't be cool. I went to school. I got a few degrees. I got a music business degree somehow. I would drink here and there. My drinking just got worse as I got into my 20s, where I got involved in some harder stuff. And then I went to school again because the kind of work I was doing, like back when I was, I'm 37 now, but when I was like 20, in my 20s and 18 and stuff, you couldn't get hired anywhere if you had tattoos or colored hair, if you were in the public. Nowadays, that's definitely changed a lot. But all my jobs were in customer service, but I didn't like sitting in cubicles because I was restless, irritable, and discontent and didn't know it. So I quit that industry and got into cooking. In cooking, it made it so I could party and stuff, but I didn't like the fact that anyone, I still thought I knew better than everybody. So as soon as I graduated from my school and went back to work, by the way, I paid for school by selling cocaine so I could go to school. I got fired, and it was an easier, softer way for me then to just go back to dealing. And I did that for 9 years, and that's why I didn't really get anywhere with my cooking for a long time. And that's why I'm really like, I really have this big problem where, like, I don't like it when everyone that works over me is 10 years younger than me. But see, this lifestyle just got more and more. Like, I could never get enough. I could just kept doing more, and I just kept getting introduced to more things and doing more stuff. And I never thought I had a problem, because as long as I could pay my rent and travel around the country and buy jewelry, clothing. I was in bands that were totally dysfunctional because I would just show up totally wrecked. But I didn't think there was any problem as long as I could pay my rent, as long as I had my girlfriend by my side. But eventually she got tired of one of the things I was doing. She wanted me to keep doing this one thing. It's hard to hate. I really hate not being able to tell my whole story, because it doesn't just involve alcohol, but alcohol was the where it started, and it made me make all the choices that led to the things that got me into my first rehab. But by the time I got to rehab, I don't know. I called up a friend when things just got too much. Let's just get to another point. There's alcohol or drugs or whatever. I can't stop using them when I start. And I never fucking understood that until I actually tried to stop. And that was the scariest day of my life. And I just kept trying to control it for a long time. And then until eventually my girlfriend told me to get out of the house or to stop doing what I was doing, and I didn't know what to do. So I called a friend of mine who I had seen get out of the hard life he had had, and he had this other dude call me and said, and the first conversation I said to him was, I just want to drink like a normal person. Like, I just want to have, like, a few drinks, maybe do cocaine on the weekends, meth once a month. And then I got introduced to AA, and I ran into a lot of other people who had those ideas before. But I thought the only thing that I needed was to go to treatment. So I got into treatment, and it did what it did. I got clean, and I got sober, and I stayed sober for 9 months. But for two times that I went through AA, I always remembered that I was doing it because I was trying to keep something. Either keep all this money I had saved or keep this relationship. And it didn't work ever, you know. I didn't really know. I thought I believed in something, like a higher power, I don't know. My story is just so, there's just so much shit. So it's hard. I mean, sorry about my language. There's just so much. So I'm trying to really condense it. So let me get to where I'm at right now. This last time that I got here, I had made up a decision that I was going to go to detox. I was going to get out of detox. I was going to work the steps, and I was going to stay sober. But while I was in detox, I was so obsessed with my relationship that I decided that stealing and reading all the books of when women are from Venus and men are from Mars was a really good idea. So I was like planning on perfecting my relationship with these books. And then I just started obsessing about using and drinking, and I got out and I used for 2 more days, and then I got fired from the job I had. I didn't know what to do. I was lying to people. I told my parents I was clean and I needed to stay with them because I needed a safe place to be. But I was down in their basement doing what I was doing. I just felt miserable so much that I just threw everything I had away and woke up the next day and haven't used or drank since. Then I just started going to meetings, and what really saved my ass was, I'd heard a lot while I'd been going to meetings for some time, but the main thing that really helped me was I went to meetings because I had nothing better to do, and I'm in my spare time, I called people because I didn't really know what else to do. But then when it got really late at night and I didn't have any idea, clue, like, what to do, I prayed. I heard a prayer at a meeting that was, relieve me of this obsession before this obsession relieves me of myself. And I said that for like 14 days whenever I couldn't deal with anything. And because that worked for me, it gave me faith. And faith is what carried me through all the rest of the steps. I'm not going to go into each and individual step right now, but what I do know is I believe in something that I'm a part of and that isn't just me. I'm trying to learn how to understand myself better and learn how to love myself, because I never really had that chance in my whole lifetime. I'm quicker to tell people when I've done something wrong. I also know that there's all these different drugs I do called lust, anger, self-seeking, fear. These are called character defects, but I just consider them other drugs that get in the way of like me growing up as a person. And I meditate when some of these things. I mean, I've had some faults in this last year. You know, I went to jail. I got a medical condition I had to deal with, and I had to deal with some other hard stuff. I'm in a but I haven't drank or used or wanted to as a solution for any of this stuff. And if the thought has come up, I've had a solution quicker than I've ever imagined. And that's from all this stuff that I do in this program with the steps. And, yeah, 15 minutes is not that long. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jenna. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jenna.
I'm grateful to be here. There was a time in sobriety when I would not have been very grateful to be asked to speak. But every time I'm asked to speak at a meeting, my first thought is, why did you possibly ask me? My second thought is, thank you, God, for the opportunity. My sobriety date is June 6th of 1985, and I'm so grateful to be here tonight. I had a perfect AA day today. My husband's sponsor, who's a man that I respect greatly, talked about the perfect AA day one time with Brendan, and Brendan had called him with a problem. He said, well, it sounds like a perfect AA day to me, Brendan. And you know, I heard that and I had to laugh because my thought prior to that and in sobriety was that a perfect AA day was a day that things went my way. You know, I behaved well, everybody else behaved well, things went really well, and I had a great day. That's the perfect AA day. But what Roy was talking about was what my day was like today. I woke up this morning, and before I got very far out of bed, my head was moving 100 miles an hour, and I was annoyed about something that had happened the day before and thinking about it repeatedly. Then I hurried around and did a bunch of things and got home and proceeded to get into a fight with my husband about something. And doing the right AA thing, we both took a little time to calm down and came back together later to talk and got into another fight. So then I got to have that perfect AA day where I called my sponsor and I wrote out a little mini fourth step and we did a little mini fifth step and I got to look at my part and I got to look again at another cut of my character defects and how they still impact my life after all these years of sobriety. I think I've spent most of my life living in a fantasy. Before I got into sobriety, into AA, I lived in a fantasy world. And in sobriety, I still have that tendency. I like to think that, I have this fantasy when I got sober that if I did what I heard in an AA meeting wasn't exactly what was said, but what I heard in AA when I came in is that if I did the steps and I did everything perfectly and I showed up, that my life would get perfect. That's what I heard. And man, I'm tenacious. I'll hang on to that for a long time. So 10 years into sobriety, I was really disappointed that that hadn't happened. And then I was sure it would happen by 20. And then by 20, it still hadn't happened. That was about the time I finally got the fact that that's not what this is about. This is about living life. This is about living real life and the things that happen in life and that we get to stay sober and handle it and show up in some sort of grown-up way. Took me a long time to be grown up. You know, physically I grew up a long time ago, but emotionally and mentally, sometimes I'm still not, but most of the time I can show up like a grown up today. I got sober in Arizona, that's where I grew up, in Tucson, and I come from an alcoholic home. My dad got into recovery about 5 years after I did, and he is also still sober, thank God. So now we have an AA family, which is really great. But my dad was an alcoholic. My dad was an extremely functional alcoholic. So he showed up to work. He ran his own business. He still has that business. We had a home. We had food. You know, all of that stuff was taken care of. My parents are still married. Sometimes I don't know why, but they're still married. I didn't come from what looked like a broken home. My mom has been in multiple programs and Debtors Anonymous and Overeaters Anonymous and Al-Anon, and she's tried all kinds of things and nothing's really stuck for her. But I came from that family, and on the outside, our family looked fine. You know, they had two kids, there were two cars in the garage, we had everything we needed, we went to church every Sunday. Everything looked great. My mom was a nurse, and my dad had his own business. Everything looked fine. But on the inside, it was crazy. My dad was a really great guy when he was drunk, And when he wasn't drunk, not such a great guy, you know? So there was a lot of shame and a lot of rage and a lot of anger in my household. My mom was what I refer to now at that point as a flaming codependent who just would do everything and anything to try to keep the peace at home. And she was mentally ill and had multiple suicidal attempts and in mental hospitals for those attempts. So this was what was going on inside the house. As the oldest of two kids, the way that I dealt with that was I tried to be perfect. And so I figured if I could be perfect enough that everything would be okay and that my parents would be happy and that I could be happy. And I set about my life at a very young age doing that. I was a swimmer, because in Arizona, there's not really anything else to do. So you're a swimmer, you don't do anything. So I was a swimmer, and if I, you know, it was at a really young age. If I got second place, I was devastated, and I was crying, and nobody could console me. If I got anything other than an A in school, I was devastated. I remember being in early middle school, and I got a C on this pre-algebra test, and I was outside crying, and nobody could console me, you know, that whole thing. And there, we got bused to this Southside school for a magnet school for fine arts, and this Mexican kid that I knew, he was huge, tall, and he was huge, and he came up to me, he looked like this big bear, but he was so sweet, came up to me and said, "Why are you crying?" I got a C, you know, all the drama that only a preteen could muster. And I remember he looked at me and he said, "Well, I would have been happy if I got a C." You know, I mean, the perspective that I didn't have, I had no perspective on anything at that time in my life other than if I didn't do it perfectly, I was a failure and life wasn't going to be okay. I began drinking. Not long after that, alcohol was a part of our house all the time. There weren't big drunk episodes. People were just drinking all the time. And everybody was nice when they were drinking. So I didn't really have a sense of alcohol being a problem in our family. I knew it was there. I would go get my dad's Coors with the little pull tabs and bring it to my dad. And I knew it was around. But it wasn't a problem that I knew of at the time. And I went to a 7th and 8th grade party at somebody's house, and I had to manipulate my way to get into it because of all these, you know, dramatic things that were going on. So I manipulated my way in. I got to this party, and I was really, really upset. And someone had mentioned that there were older kids out front that had booze, and I strode out there with purpose, and I looked at these people that I didn't know, and I said, "Get me drunk." And they opened up the cooler, and there was all the booze in there. And I grabbed what turned out to be a bottle of Jack Daniels and three beers. And I had not drank before, really, other than sips of my dad's beer. So I stuck the Jack Daniels bottle down my throat as far as it would go, and I chugged the whole thing. By the time I realized it burned, it was gone. So I grabbed a cold beer to take care of that, and I chugged those really quickly. They tasted horrible, but, you know. So that was my first drunk, was getting so drunk that I browned out and I came to periodically, and I had found my medicine. I had found my cure. I was painfully shy. I hated myself. If I didn't do it perfectly, I hated myself more. I hated everybody else but wanted everybody to like me. I was a miserable person, and this was my medicine. So I got really, really drunk. And I proceeded to go around the party with this painfully shy person with this new confidence and all of the resentments that I'd been building for years with these people that I went to school with. And I went around the party and told everybody what I thought about them. And none of it was nice. And I locked myself in the bathroom and threatened to kill myself if somebody didn't call the teachers so I could tell them what I thought of them. And I mean, and I took all my clothes off and jumped in the pool. And I just, like, this was it. I would found my cure. And, you know, we, as we do as alcoholics, we tend to attract people who are codependent and will support our drinking process. And the parents of the boy whose house this was happening at, I remember being in their kitchen with a cup of coffee. And they sent me home in my mom's car and never told her a thing. So nobody in my house knew what had happened. But from that point on, drinking was a daily event for me. And I'd go to school with my Coke can filled with vodka and drink in the classroom. And And drinking was a little bit tough at that age. It was hard to get a hold of booze and make sure there was enough still at home that nobody noticed it was gone. So drugs were a part of my story. It was a little easier to get a hold of. And I won't talk much about it, but it was the same sort of insanity and the same sort of addiction and that behavior with my drugs that there was with my alcohol. I got stoned for the first time, and I smoked 7 bowls because the first few weren't working. And by the time I got to the 7th one, I blacked out. I mean, who except somebody in this room would black out from smoking pot? It just doesn't happen. So that's the way I approached all of my drinking and all of my addictive behavior. I began missing school. I began not caring. I didn't care anymore. I didn't care if I missed school. I didn't care if I was failing. I quit swimming. I had a whole new set of friends who drank and drugged like me. Lot different crowd. I began getting into situations that I never would have been in before. And there are lots of different ways to get alcohol when you're young. I would be hitchhiking on the side of the road at 13, 14 years old with tight pants and a little crop top. I'm amazed that more bad things didn't happen to me. I'm amazed that I got sober and I stayed alive. At that point in my life, I didn't want to stay alive, really. I was too chicken to kill myself, but I was just going to keep going the way I was going and pushing all the limits and pushing all the boundaries and not caring about myself. We've all drank and we've all used. You guys have all been there. I don't need to belabor that too much longer. But at the end of my drinking, my last big hoorah before I got sober, I went to, let's see what had happened. We stole my parents' car. We got caught. I was grounded forever, it seemed like. And then it was graduation, and I didn't want to miss out on graduation. So I was furious that my parents would even think of keeping me from graduation party night. And so to show them and to get what I wanted, I ran away. I went to school that day, and I just didn't come back. And I slept in my friend's bedroom while her mom worked nights and just slept in her bedroom. And moved around houses to different people because people would get tired of me. I kind of burned people out in my life. I'd use them, and then they didn't want me around anymore, and that was a theme. So I kept having to move houses and move to different places where my friends, you know, were all young, so they'd have to hide me in their bedroom and bring me sandwiches, and it was ridiculous. But I got to go to graduation night party. My friend that I had been staying with for a few nights, we went to this party, and we're both too young to drive. You know, we're both 15. So we got a ride out there, and in Arizona, we party out in the middle of the desert because nobody can hear us and we don't get in trouble. So we're out in the middle of nowhere having our bonfire and having a party, and it's mostly people I don't know. And we got really drunk, and we took some acid, and pretty soon my friend was gone. I'm sure that she got the first chance she could to ditch me, and she took off. And I was there alone, and it was about 3:30 in the morning. The party was kind of dying out, and I had no ride back to town. I didn't know anybody. I walked up to a group of guys that I didn't know and asked them if they could drive me home, and I was just stumbling drunk. This is the kind of stuff that I get myself into all the time. And so we're driving home, and it's one of those old cars where you have the three seats across the front. We're all sitting in there, and the guy on this side is whispering in my ear and had his hand on my leg, and I'm over here whispering in this guy's ear and had my hand on his leg, and it was all just craziness. And they just dropped me off. You know, again, I got somehow I managed to get out of this thing without getting into as bad a situation as I could have, and I'm forever grateful for that. But they took me home. It's 4:00 in the morning. I went to get the key to go in, and it wasn't there. And I'm furious again that my parents would not leave me the key. And about halfway through pounding on the door and yelling and ringing the doorbell, I remembered that I'd run away, and I wasn't meaning to go home, but here I was. So, you know, my parents came to the door, and they were very angry, and they wouldn't let me in, and couple minutes later, the cops pulled up, and sitting in the living room with the cops talking to me about how I shouldn't do this, and the floor is doing this, and I'm wondering how I'm going to get out of this. And, you know, they ended up taking me into juvie, and nobody wanted to put me in juvie for a runaway. You know, I had, this is that fantasy again, I had this fantasy that if I was going to be doing what I was doing, I was the baddest of the bad, you know, and here I was going to juvie for a runaway charge. But nobody wanted to put me in, they just wanted to scare me. They told me I could stay in juvie for 30 days or I could go to a treatment center. And, you know, all my wisdom, I picked the treatment center because I knew with a little crying and a little looking sad that I could probably get out of there pretty quick. So I went to an inpatient treatment facility on June 6th of 1985, and that was my last drink and my last drug. I was 15. I had no reason to get this thing. As I came in here, and you guys had done it for a lot longer than me, and things had been a lot worse, and you'd seen a lot more than I had. And I had no reason to get it when I did, but I don't believe it was because of me. I believe it was because of the higher power that I came to believe in eventually in this program. So I was in treatment with 18 other teenagers, and it was fun. We had a great time. I was in detox for about 5 days. I had been doing heroin and cocaine at that point, so I had some detoxing to do before they let me out amongst the general population. But I stayed there for 6 weeks, and we had a blast. I had a community. We laughed a lot. We did a lot of crazy and stupid things, and we got taken to AA meetings and NA meetings and CA meetings. You know, we got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And to get out, I had to get a sponsor. So I had a sponsor who had 30 days more than I did and who really hadn't worked the steps either. So I called her a couple times after I got out, and that was the end of that. But for the first 6 months of my sobriety, all the people I went to treatment with, we were all together. We all went to meetings together. We went to aftercare. We stayed up all night. We didn't go to school because we were trying to get sober. So we didn't go to school. We just did this. And it was really fun. And about 6 months into sobriety, the last person that I had been in treatment with went back out, and it was my best friend, Christine, and she started drinking again, and I was alone, and I was scared. And this was where the rubber met the road for me in this program. This was one of the times. There have been many of them, but one of the times where that happened, where I no longer had all these other people to keep me busy and keep this fun, and it was down to, do I want to stay sober or not? Did I really want this thing? And I had no idea. I knew I didn't want to go back to the life I'd had before. I knew that I was miserable before. I knew that when I walked into treatment and they told me what my problem was, that I felt a huge amount of relief. Because for the first time, it had never once occurred to me that alcohol and drugs were my problem. Not once. I mean, in the face of huge mounds of evidence, it never occurred to me. And nobody had said that before. And when I got into treatment and they told me that that was my problem, I was relieved because I had known something was wrong with me for a really long time. Even before I picked up, I knew something was wrong with me and terribly wrong. And when they told me that, I had this sense of relief because at the same time they told me that, they told me they had a solution and that AA was the solution. You know, my alcoholism is a whole lot more than drinking. Drinking was really my solution for a long time, which ended up turning on me. But the ism, all that other stuff, Bill writes about it, and I don't remember where, but about those emotional and mental twists, those deep ones that really damage us and change who we are, those things are all still there. I felt like I was home, and I'd come to meetings, and you guys would be talking about DUIs and about losing your family and all of these things. And I didn't relate to the specifics, but I related to how you felt. So at 6 months of sobriety, I ended up wanting to drink because I was scared. And I called an old drinking buddy and I asked him if he'd come over and get me. And as soon as I hung up, I was so terrified and I knew that was the wrong thing. And I didn't know what to do, so I picked up the phone like I'd been told in AA, and I called somebody, and I said, I just called somebody to come over and get me, to bring me booze and get me drunk. And so she came over and got there first, and we went to a meeting. You know, it was a for me, it was a difficult road after that for a while because I was the youngest person in AA in our area. The next group of people were in their early 20s, and there just was that big gap there. So I felt lonely, and I felt scared, but the people in AA took care of me, you know? They really took care of me. They babysat me. They helped me through. They stood by me. I had a... About a year, I got a boyfriend who wasn't in the program. I was lifeguarding at the time, and he'd come into the pool, and he was a year older than me. And funny how we pick the people. You know, we pick them. I picked an alcoholic, you know? There's something attractive about him. I knew that. And so he was my boyfriend for 5 years. And I hit a really... bad point with that about a year and a half into sobriety, and I was nuts. I had not worked the steps. I had worked part of the first step, which is that I knew that I was powerless over alcohol, and I knew that my life before sobriety was unmanageable. But once I got sober, I kind of, not consciously, but I somewhere decided that my life was now manageable by me. And then I didn't really get a sponsor, and I didn't really work the steps. All I did at first was go to meetings and not drink. Go to meetings and not drink. And that's what I did a lot. I went to lots of meetings and I didn't drink. I don't recommend it, but it's what I did. And so by the time this thing happened with my boyfriend, I was absolutely insane. You know, I hadn't gotten to step two and I hadn't gotten to step three. I hadn't gotten to those steps where they talk about being insane and that we have some relief for that insanity through Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I was so crazy. And I remember getting it. I was 16 years old, and I got into my car, and I didn't believe in God at that point. I didn't believe in any sort of higher power. It didn't have to be called God, but I didn't believe in a higher power. In fact, I had decided I was atheist. I did not know what atheist meant, but I knew it meant something like you didn't believe in God. So that's what I was. And I got in my car, and I was screaming at this higher power that I didn't believe, that I'm going to drink if there's not a woman at the Alano Club. And so I'm speeding along, you know, being really dramatic. And I got to the Alano Club. It was a Sunday afternoon, earlier than this. And on a Sunday afternoon at the Alano Club, there no woman in her right mind would be there. They had the meeting hall, and then they had the pool table and the bridge table and the card table, and it would be filled with smoke. And there, we used to, I did have a few friends who they were a little older than me, but we used to call it Dead Pecker Row because it would be a line of guys sitting there smoking. And so I was sure there wouldn't be anybody there, and I'd be safe to go drink. So I screaming at this as I'm speeding down the street, and I screeched into the Alano Club parking lot with all the drama that a 16-year-old girl can. And I flung the door open, and billows of smoke come out, and it's hard to see in there because it's so dark. And there was one woman sitting against the wall with all those guys. And I went up to her, and I said, I need to talk to you. And it was this big deal. So she went in the meeting room and talked to me, and she became what I consider my first real sponsor, as the first person I worked the steps with. And Linda was so patient. So patient with me. Linda, I became like this little chick following Linda around. I joined her home group, and I sat next to her, and we'd sit there and we'd smoke, and we would go to the home group meeting, and I had a service position, and I just did pretty much whatever Linda told me to do. And at that point, the insanity of my disease was what got me to that point again, where I was willing to do whatever it took, that, you know, I was willing to take instruction. I'm an alcoholic who likes to think I know everything and know what's best for me and for everybody around me, and I don't take instruction well, a little bit defiant, but I was willing. You know, that surrender point happened again. And so Linda took me through the steps, and I did my first fourth and fifth step. And, you know, I thank God that I didn't always understand everything. You know, I didn't understand the steps. It took me 6 months to be able to even understand what they were saying. My brain was a little fuzzy when I first got here. But also, I just didn't understand the deeper meaning of any of it. And when I looked at the fourth step, I was really excited to do the fourth step. I could not understand why people in meetings were so afraid of doing the fourth and fifth step. Because the way I read it was that I got to write down everything everybody had done to me. And then I got to tell somebody about it. How people had wronged me. Get to put it on paper. Look at that. And I was really excited about doing my fourth and fifth step. So thankfully, that's the way I felt, and I went at it with a lot of gusto, and I wrote every single thing I could ever think of in my life. I had pages and pages of people who had wronged me and who I was angry at. And we did my fifth step, and that was really a major turning point for me in sobriety. I went from that person who showed up for meetings and left afterwards and didn't really, it was kind of on the outside of AA, to feeling a part of AA. I had walked through the trenches of AA. I had done my fourth and fifth step, and I came out of that with, again, the first time in my life really knowing that I had a part. I didn't know that before. Again, in the face of all this evidence, I had no idea that I had a part in things. Everything was done to me. So when I did my fifth step, I really got what my part was and that I even had a part. And I had that moment of willingness. I think that's why they have us go right into 6 and 7 at that point, because we're so willing after reading that and looking at all that. So I went and did my, Linda took me through the big book, and I went and did my 6th and 7th afterwards. And proceeded on with my 8th and 9th and made amends. And again, I had some that I was afraid to make, but the relief I got out of doing those amends was so huge that it almost became exciting to go do them. I found a fellowship in this program. I found my people. I found my family here. I found a place where I could learn to live my life. So once I got past all those fantasies about how life was going to get perfect, this is a place where I can live life here. So when something happens at work and I get mad at somebody, I don't have to sit there and stew and be resentful. I do sometimes, but I don't have to. I know what to do. I come here, I call my sponsor, I look at my part, I clean up any mess I made, and then I'm free here. I was never free before. And doing my fourth and fifth step and doing my amends gave me that freedom for the first time. I also found a higher power here, which is not something I really wanted. I was pretty sure that I didn't want that. I didn't like the one I grew up with, and I wanted to be different. I didn't want to be somebody who believed in that, and I didn't for a long time. But eventually I found a higher power that worked for me, and it took a long time, and it was really slow. But again, that has given me another level of freedom. Because at any point in this program, no matter how many years I have, I can go back to being in charge and trying to manage my life myself and trying to make things happen the way that I want them to happen. And now, I get really uncomfortable really fast. Used to be that I would just put my head down and I'm going to barrel through it. And I've done that a lot. And I've gotten so far with that. But eventually, the insanity and the stress and the feeling exhausted, trying to manage it all, at least I know where to go now. I have a woman that I work with who is 28 years sober, and she did it a different way. She doesn't go to AA. And there are lots of ways to do this thing. But one of the things that I appreciate so much about this program is that it teaches us to look at ourselves. And it gives us a higher power of some sort, whatever we choose it to be. And I don't see that with her. And I see that when there's an upset, I see her as a 60-year-old woman storming out of the room and slamming the door and not able to come back and talk about her part because she doesn't know. She doesn't have what we have here. I got married in this program and to someone else in the program. I have 2 kids who are 13 and 9 that were born after I got sober. Thankfully, because I was 15, that would have been a bad thing. I went back to school. There was an old cowboy that in Tucson where I got sober, and he was so old, and he was so mean and crotchety, but he was sober for what I thought was forever at that time. And he used to say that drunks do 2 things. When they get sober, they get their teeth fixed and they go back to school. And I did. I went back to school. I finished high school. I went to college. Went to graduate school. I have a profession. People pay me to take care of them. People trust me today. I have a life that I didn't think I'd ever have. In fact, I didn't think I wanted this life. But now that I have it, I'm so grateful. And I'm so grateful to all of you for being here tonight and giving me the opportunity to share. And with that, I'm going to stop 2 minutes early. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.